can make allowances for you, gentlemen. I can quite make allowances. I'm struck all of a heap myself, for who can have murdered him if not I? That's what it comes to, isn't it? If not I, who can it be? Who? Gentlemen, I want to know, I insist on knowing, he exclaimed suddenly. Where was he murdered? How was he murdered? How and with what? Tell me, he asked quickly, looking at the two lawyers. We found him in his study, lying on his back on the floor, with his head battered in, said the prosecutor. That's horrible. Mitya shuddered, and putting his elbows on the table, hid his face in his right hand.
We will continue, interposed Nikolai Parfenovitch. So what was it that impelled you to this sentiment of hatred? You have asserted in public, I believe, that it was based upon jealousy.
Well, yes, jealousy, and not only jealousy.
Disputes about money?
Yes, about money, too.
There was a dispute about 3,000 rubles, I think, which you claimed as part of your inheritance.
3,000? More, more, cried Mitya hotly. More than 6,000, more than 10, perhaps. I told everyone so, shouted it at them, but I made up my mind to let it go at 3,000. I was desperately in need of that 3,000. So the bundle of notes for 3,000 that I know he kept under his pillow, ready for Grushenka, I considered as simply stolen from me. Yes, gentlemen, I looked upon it as mine, as my own property.
The prosecutor looked significantly at the investigating lawyer, and had time to wink at him on the sly.
We will return to that subject later, said the lawyer promptly. You will allow us to note that point and write it down that you looked upon that money as your own property.
Write it down, by all means. I know that's another fact that tells against me, but I'm not afraid of facts, and I tell them against myself. Do you hear? Do you know, gentlemen, you take me for a different sort of man from what I am? He added, suddenly gloomy and dejected. You have to deal with a man of honour, a man of the highest honour. Above all, don't lose sight of it. A man who's done a lot of nasty things, but has always been and still is honourable at bottom in his inner being. I don't know how to express it. That's just what's made me wretched all my life, that I yearned to be honourable, that I was, so to say, a martyr to a sense of honour, seeking for it with a lantern, with the lantern of Diogenes, and yet all my life I've been doing filthy things, like all of us, gentlemen. That is, like me alone. That was a mistake. Like me alone, me alone. Gentlemen, my head aches.
His brows contracted with pain.
You see, gentlemen, I couldn't bear the look of him. There was something in him ignoble, impotent, trampling on everything sacred, something sneering and irreverent, loathsome, loathsome. But now that he's dead, I feel differently.
How do you mean?
I don't feel differently, but I wish I hadn't hated him so.
You feel penitent?
No, not penitent. Don't write that. I'm not much good myself. I'm not very beautiful, so I had no right to consider him repulsive. That's what I mean. Write that down, if you like.
Saying this, Mitya became very mournful. He'd grown more and more gloomy as the inquiry continued. At this moment, another unexpected scene followed. Though Grushenka had been moved, she'd not been taken far away. Only into the room next but one from the blue room in which the examination was proceeding. It was a little room with one window, next beyond the large room in which they had danced and feasted so lavishly. She was sitting there with no one by her but Maximov, who was terribly depressed, terribly scared, and clung to her side as though for security. At their door stood one of the peasants with a metal plate on his breast. Grushenka was crying, and suddenly her grief was too much for her. She jumped up, flung up her arms, and with a loud wail of sorrow rushed out of the room to him, to her Mitya, and so unexpectedly that they had not time to stop her. Mitya, hearing her cry, trembled, jumped up, and with a yell rushed impetuously to meet her, not knowing what he was doing. But they were not allowed to come together, though they saw one another. He was seized by the arms, he struggled and tried to tear himself away. It took 3 or 4 men to hold him. She was seized, too, and he saw her stretching out her arms to him, crying aloud as they carried her away. When the scene was over, he came to himself again, sitting in the same place as before, opposite the investigating lawyer, and crying out to them, "What do you want with her? Why do you torment her? She's done nothing, nothing." The lawyers tried to soothe him. About 10 minutes passed like this. At last, Mihail Makarovich, who had been absent, came hurriedly into the room and said in a loud and excited voice to the prosecutor, "She's been removed. She's downstairs. Will you allow me to say one word to this unhappy man, gentlemen? In your presence, gentlemen, in your presence."
"By all means, Mihail Makarovich," answered the investigating lawyer. "In the present case, we have nothing against it."
"Listen, Dmitri Fyodorovich, my dear fellow," began the police captain, and there was a look of warm, almost fatherly feeling for the luckless prisoner on his excited face. "I took your Agrafena Alexandrovna downstairs myself, and confided her to the care of the landlord's daughters, and that old fellow Maximov is with her all the time. And I soothed her, do you hear? I soothed and calmed her. I impressed on her that you have to clear yourself, so she mustn't hinder you, must not depress you, or you may lose your head and say the wrong thing in your evidence. In fact, I talked to her, and she understood. She's a sensible girl, my boy, a good-hearted girl. She would have kissed my old hands, begging help for you. She sent me herself to tell you not to worry about her, and I must go, my dear fellow. I must go and tell her that you are calm and comforted about her. And so you must be calm, do you understand? I was unfair to her. She is a Christian soul, gentlemen. Yes, I tell you, she's a gentle soul and not to blame for anything. So, what am I to tell her, Dmitri Fyodorovich? Will you sit quiet or not?"
The good-natured police captain said a great deal that was irregular, but Grushenka's suffering, a fellow creature's suffering, touched his good-natured heart, and tears stood in his eyes. Mitya jumped up and rushed towards him.
"Forgive me, gentlemen. Oh, allow me, allow me," he cried. "You've the heart of an angel, Mikhail Makarovich. I thank you for her. I will be calm, cheerful, in fact. Tell her in the kindness of your heart that I am cheerful, quite cheerful, that I shall be laughing in a minute, knowing that she has a guardian angel like you. I shall have done with all this directly, and as soon as I'm free I'll be with her. She'll see. Let her wait. Gentlemen," he said, turning to the two lawyers, "now I'll open my whole soul to you. I'll pour out everything. We'll finish this off directly, finish it off gaily. We shall laugh at it in the end, shan't we? But, gentlemen, that woman is the queen of my heart. Oh, let me tell you that. That one thing I'll tell you now. I see I'm with honourable men. She is my light. She is my holy one. And if only you knew. Did you hear her cry, 'I'll go to death with you'? And what have I, a penniless beggar, done for her? Why such love for me? How can a clumsy, ugly brute like me, with my ugly face, deserve such love that she is ready to go to exile with me? And how she fell down at your feet for my sake just now, and yet she's proud and has done nothing. How can I help adoring her? How can I help crying out and rushing to her as I did just now? Gentlemen, forgive me, but now I am comforted."
And he sank back in his chair and, covering his face with his hands, burst into tears. But they were happy tears. He recovered himself instantly. The old police captain seemed much pleased, and the lawyers also. They felt that the examination was passing into a new phase. When the police captain went out, Mitya was positively gay.
"Now, gentlemen, I am at your disposal, entirely at your disposal, and if it were not for all these trivial details, we should understand one another in a minute. I'm at these details again. I'm at your disposal, gentlemen, but I declare that we must have mutual confidence, you in me and I in you, or there'll be no end to it. I speak in your interests. To business, gentlemen, to business, and don't rummage in my soul. Don't tease me with trifles, but only ask me about facts and what matters, and I will satisfy you at once. And damn the details."
So spoke Mitya. The interrogation began again. Chapter 4. The Second Ordeal.
"You don't know how you encourage us, Dmitri Fyodorovich, by your readiness to answer," said Nikolai Parfenovitch, with an animated air and obvious satisfaction beaming in his very prominent, short-sighted, light-grey eyes, from which he had removed his spectacles a moment before. "And you have made a very just remark about the mutual confidence, without which it is sometimes positively impossible to get on in cases of such importance. If the suspected party really hopes and desires to defend himself and is in a position to do so, we on our side will do everything in our power, and you can see for yourself how we are conducting the case. You approve, Ippolit Kirillovich?" He turned to the prosecutor.
"Oh, undoubtedly," replied the prosecutor. His tone was somewhat cold compared with Nikolai Parfenovich's impulsiveness. I will note once for all that Nikolai Parfenovich, who had but lately arrived among us, had from the first felt marked respect for Ippolit Kirillovich, our prosecutor, and had become almost his bosom friend. He was almost the only person who put implicit faith in Ippolit Kirillovich's extraordinary talents as a psychologist and orator, and in the justice of his grievance. He had heard of him in Petersburg. On the other hand, young Nikolai Parfenovich was the only person in the whole world whom our unappreciated prosecutor genuinely liked. On their way to Mokroe, they had time to come to an understanding about the present case. And now, as they sat at the table, the sharp-witted junior caught and interpreted every indication on his senior colleague's face, at half a word, at a glance, or at a wink. "Gentlemen, only let me tell my own story and don't interrupt me with trivial questions, and I'll tell you everything in a moment," said Mitya excitedly. "Excellent, thank you. But before we proceed to listen to your communication, will you allow me to inquire as to another little fact of great interest to us? I mean the 10 rubles you borrowed yesterday at about 5 o'clock on the security of your pistols from your friend Pyotr Ilyich Perotin." "I pledged them, gentlemen. I pledged them for 10 rubles. What more? That's all about it. As soon as I got back to town, I pledged them."
"You got back to town? Then had you been out of town?"
"Yes, I went on a journey of 40 versts into the country. Didn't you know?"
The prosecutor and Nikolai Parfenovich exchanged glances. "Well, how would it be if you began your story with a systematic description of all you did yesterday, from the morning onwards? Allow us, for instance, to inquire why you were absent from the town, and just when you left and when you came back. All those facts."
"You should have asked me like that from the beginning," cried Mitya, laughing aloud. "And if you like, we won't begin from yesterday, but from the morning of the day before. Then you'll understand how, why, and where I went. I went the day before yesterday, gentlemen, to a merchant of the town called Samsonov, to borrow 3,000 rubles from him on safe security. It was a pressing matter, gentlemen. It was a sudden necessity."
"Allow me to interrupt you," the prosecutor put in politely. "Why were you in such pressing need for just that sum, 3,000?
"Oh, gentlemen, you needn't go into details how, when, and why just so much money and not so much and all that rigmarole. Why, it'll run to 3 volumes, and then you'll want an epilogue."
Mitya said all this with the good-natured but impatient familiarity of a man who is anxious to tell the whole truth and is full of the best intentions.
"Gentlemen," he corrected himself hurriedly, "don't be vexed with me for my restiveness, I beg you again. Believe me once more, I feel the greatest respect for you and understand the true position of affairs. Don't think I'm drunk, I'm quite sober now. And besides, being drunk would be no hindrance. It's with me, you know, like the saying, when he is sober, he is a fool. When he is drunk, he's a wise man. Ha, ha! But I see, gentlemen, it's not the proper thing to make jokes to you. Till we've had our explanation, I mean. And I've my own dignity to keep up, too. I quite understand the difference for the moment. I am, after all, in the position of a criminal, and so far from being on equal terms with you. And it's your business to watch me. I can't expect you to pat me on the head for what I did to Grigory, for one can't break old men's heads with impunity. I suppose you'll put me away from him for 6 months, or a year perhaps, in a house of correction. I don't know what the punishment is, but it will be without loss of the rights of my rank, without loss of my rank, won't it? So you see, gentlemen, I understand the distinction between us, but you must see that you could puzzle God himself with such questions. How did you step? Where did you step? When did you step? And on what did you step? I shall get mixed up if you go on like this, and you will put it all down against me. And what will that lead to? To nothing. And even if it's nonsense I'm talking now, let me finish, and you, gentlemen, being men of honour and refinement, will forgive me. I'll finish by asking you, gentlemen, to drop that conventional method of questioning. I mean, beginning from some miserable trifle, how I got up, what I had for breakfast, how I spat, and where I spat, and so distracting the attention of the criminal, suddenly stun him with an overwhelming question, whom did you murder, whom did you rob? Ha, ha, ha! That's your regulation method. That's where all your cunning comes in. You can put peasants off their guard like that, but not me. I know the tricks. I've been in the service, too. Ha, ha, ha! "'You're not angry, gentlemen. You forgive my impertinence?' he cried, looking at them with a good nature that was almost surprising. "'It's only Mitya Karamazov, you know, so you can overlook it. It would be inexcusable in a sensible man. But you can forgive it in Mitya. Ha, ha, ha!'
Nikolai Parfenovitch listened and laughed, too. Though the prosecutor did not laugh, he kept his eyes fixed keenly on Mitya, as though anxious not to miss the least syllable, the slightest movement, the smallest twitch of any feature of his face.
"'That's how we've treated you from the beginning,' said Nikolai Parfenovitch, still laughing. "'We haven't tried to put you out by asking how you got up in the morning and what you had for breakfast. We began, indeed, with questions of the greatest importance.'
"'I understand. I saw it and appreciated it. And I appreciate still more your present kindness to me, an unprecedented kindness worthy of your noble hearts. We three here are gentlemen, and let everything be on the footing of mutual confidence between educated, well-bred people, who have the common bond of noble birth and honour. In any case, allow me to look upon you as my best friends at this moment of my life, at this moment when my honour is assailed. That's no offence to you, gentlemen, is it?
On the contrary, you expressed all that so well, Dmitri Fyodorovitch.
Nikolai Parfenovitch answered with dignified approbation.
And enough of those trivial questions, gentlemen, all those tricky questions, cried Mitya enthusiastically, or there's simply no knowing where we shall get to, is there?
I will follow your sensible advice entirely, the prosecutor interposed, addressing Mitya. But I don't withdraw my question, however. It is now vitally important for us to know exactly why you needed that sum. I mean, precisely 3,000.
Why I needed it? Oh, for one thing and another. Well, it was to pay a debt.
A debt to whom?
That I absolutely refuse to answer, gentlemen, not because I couldn't or because I shouldn't dare, or because it would be damaging, for it's all a paltry matter and absolutely trifling, but I won't, because it's a matter of principle. That's my private life, and I won't allow any intrusion into my private life. That's my principle. Your question has no bearing on the case, and whatever has nothing to do with the case is my private affair. I wanted to pay a debt. I wanted to pay a debt of honour. But to whom, I won't say.
Allow me to make a note of that, said the prosecutor.
By all means, write down that I won't say that I won't. Write that I should think it dishonourable to say. Eh, you can write it. You've nothing else to do with your time.
Allow me to caution you, sir, and to remind you once more, if you are unaware of it,
the prosecutor began with a peculiar and stern impressiveness,
that you have a perfect right not to answer the questions put to you now, and we, on our side, have no right to extort an answer from you, if you decline to give it for one reason or another. That is entirely a matter for your personal decision. But it is our duty, on the other hand, in such cases as the present, to explain and set before you the degree of injury you will be doing yourself by refusing to give this or that piece of evidence. After which I will beg you to continue.
Gentlemen, I'm not angry,
Mitya muttered in a rather disconcerted tone.
Well, gentlemen, you see, that Samsonov to whom I went then...
We will, of course, not reproduce his account of what is known to the reader already. Mitya was impatiently anxious not to omit the slightest detail. At the same time, he was in a hurry to get it over. But as he gave his evidence, it was written down, and therefore they had continually to pull him up. Mitya disliked this, but submitted, got angry, though still good-humouredly. He did, it is true, exclaim from time to time,
"Gentlemen, that's enough to make an angel out of patience." Or, "Gentlemen, it's no good you're irritating me."
But even though he exclaimed, he still preserved for a time his genially expansive mood. So he told them how Samsonov had made a fool of him 2 days before. He had completely realized by now that he had been fooled. The sale of his watch for 6 rubles to obtain money for the journey was something new to the lawyers. They were at once greatly interested, and even, to Mitya's intense indignation, thought it necessary to write the fact down as a secondary confirmation of the circumstance that he had hardly a farthing in his pocket at the time. Little by little, Mitya began to grow surly. Then, after describing his journey to Siliagavi, the night spent in the stifling hut, and so on, he came to his return to the town.
Here he began, without being particularly urged, to give a minute account of the agonies of jealousy he endured on Grushenka's account. He was heard with silent attention, then inquired particularly into the circumstance of his having a place of ambush in Maria Kondratyevna's house, at the back of Fyodor Pavlovich's garden to keep watch on Grushenka, and of Smerdyakov's bringing him information. They laid particular stress on this, and noted it down. Of his jealousy he spoke warmly and at length, and though inwardly ashamed at exposing his most intimate feelings, so to speak, to public ignominy, he evidently overcame his shame in order to tell the truth. The frigid severity with which the investigating lawyer, and still more the prosecutor, stared intently at him as he told his story, disconcerted him at last considerably. "That boy, Nikolai Parfenovich, to whom I was talking nonsense about women only a few days ago, and that sickly prosecutor are not worth my telling, these two." He reflected mournfully. "It's ignominious. Be patient, humble, hold the peace." He wound up his reflections with that line, but he pulled himself together to go on again. When he came to telling of his visit to Madame Holokov, he regained his spirits and even wished to tell a little anecdote of that lady, which had nothing to do with the case. But the investigating lawyer stopped him and civilly suggested that he should pass on to more essential matters. At last, when he described his despair and told them how, when he left Madame Holokov's, he thought that he'd get 3,000 if he had to murder someone to do it. They stopped him again and noted down that he had meant to murder someone. Mitya let them write it without protest. At last he reached the point in his story when he learned that Grushenka deceived him and had returned from Samsonov's as soon as he left her there, though she had said that she would stay there till midnight. "If I didn't kill Fenya then, gentlemen, it was only because I hadn't time," broke from him suddenly at that point in his story. That, too, was carefully written down. Mitya waited gloomily and was beginning to tell how he ran into his father's garden, when the investigating lawyer suddenly stopped him and opened the big portfolio that lay on the sofa beside him. He brought out the brass pestle. "Do you recognize this object?" he asked, showing it to Mitya. "Oh, yes," he laughed gloomily. "Of course I recognize it. Let me have a look at it." "Damn it, never mind."
"You have forgotten to mention it," observed the investigating lawyer.
"Hang it all, I shouldn't have concealed it from you. Do you suppose I could have managed without it? It simply escaped my memory."
"Be so good as to tell us precisely how you came to arm yourself with it."
"Certainly I will be so good, gentlemen."
And Mitya described how he took the pestle and ran. "But what object had you in view in arming yourself with such a weapon?"
"What object? No object. I just picked it up and ran off."
"What for, if you had no object?"
Mitya's wrath flared up. He looked intently at the boy, and smiled gloomily and malignantly. He was feeling more and more ashamed at having told such people the story of his jealousy so sincerely and spontaneously.
"Bother the pestle!" broke from him suddenly.
"But still..."
"Oh, but to keep off dogs. Oh, because it was dark. In case anything turned up."
"But have you ever on previous occasions taken a weapon with you when you went out, since you're afraid of the dark?"
"Oh, damn it all, gentlemen, there's positively no talking to you,"
cried Mitya, exasperated beyond endurance. And turning to the secretary, crimson with anger, he said quickly, with a note of fury in his voice,
"Write down at once, that I snatched up the pestle to go and kill my father, Fyodor Pavlovich, by hitting him on the head with it. Well, now, are you satisfied, gentlemen? Are your minds relieved?" he said, glaring defiantly at the lawyers. "We quite understand that you made that statement just now through exasperation with us, and the questions we put to you, which you consider trivial, though they are, in fact, essential,"
the prosecutor remarked dryly in reply.
"Well, upon my word, gentlemen, yes, I took the pestle. What does one pick things up for at such moments? I don't know what for. I snatched it up and ran, that's all. For to me, gentlemen, passons, or I declare I won't tell you any more." He sat with his elbows on the table and his head in his hand. He sat sideways to them and gazed at the wall, struggling against a feeling of nausea. He had, in fact, an awful inclination to get up and declare that he wouldn't say another word. Not if you hang me for it.
You see, gentlemen, he said at last, with difficulty, controlling himself, you see, I listen to you and I'm haunted by a dream. It's a dream I have sometimes, you know. I often dream it is always the same. That someone is hunting me, someone I'm awfully afraid of. That he's hunting me in the dark, in the night, tracking me, and I hide somewhere from him behind a door or cupboard, hide in a degrading way, and the worst of it is he always knows where I am, but he pretends not to know where I am on purpose to prolong my agony, to enjoy my terror. That's just what you're doing now, it's just like that.
Is that the sort of thing you dream about? Inquired the prosecutor.
Yes, it is. Don't you want to write it down?
Said Mitya with a distorted smile.
No, no need to write it down. But still, you do have curious dreams.
It's not a question of dreams now, gentlemen. This is realism, this is real life. I'm a wolf and you're the hunters. Well, hunt him down.
You are wrong to make such comparisons, began Nikolai Parfenovitch with extraordinary softness.
No, I'm not wrong, not at all.
Mitya flared up again, though his outburst of wrath had obviously relieved his heart. He grew more good-humoured at every word.
You may not trust a criminal or a man on trial, tortured by your questions, but an honourable man, the honourable impulses of the heart, I say that boldly, no. That you must believe, you have no right indeed. But be silent, heart, be patient, humble. Hold thy peace.
Well, shall I go on?
He broke off gloomily.
If you'll be so kind, answered Nikolai Parfenovitch.
This book is continued on Disc 3. The Brothers Karamazov by Fyodor Dostoevsky. Disc 3. Chapter 5. The Third Ordeal. Though Mitya spoke sullenly, it was evident that he was trying more than ever not to forget or miss a single detail of his story. He told them how he'd leapt over the fence into his father's garden, how he had gone up to the window, told them all that had passed under the window. Clearly, precisely, distinctly, he described the feelings that troubled him during those moments in the garden when he longed so terribly to know whether Grushenka was with his father or not. But strange to say, both the lawyers listened now with a sort of awful reserve, looked coldly at him, asked few questions. Mitya could gather nothing from their faces. They're angry and offended, he thought. Well, bother them. When he described how he made up his mind at last to make the signal to his father that Grushenka had come, so that he should open the window, the lawyers paid no attention to the word signal, as though they entirely failed to grasp the meaning of the word in this connection. So much so that Mitya noticed it, coming at last to the moment when, seeing his father peering out of the window, his hatred flared up and he pulled the pestle out of his pocket. He suddenly, as though of design, stopped short. He sat gazing at the wall and was aware that their eyes were fixed upon him.
"Well," said the investigating lawyer, "you pulled out the weapon and...
And what happened then?
Then? Why, then I murdered him, hit him on the head and cracked his skull. I suppose that's your story. That's it."
His eyes suddenly flashed. All his smothered wrath suddenly flamed up with extraordinary violence in his soul.
"Our story?" repeated Nikolai Parfenovitch. "Well, and yours?"
Mitya dropped his eyes and was for a long time silent.
"My story, gentlemen. Well, it was like this," he began softly. "Whether it was someone's tears, or my mother prayed to God, or a good angel kissed me at that instant, I don't know. But the devil was conquered. I rushed from the window and ran to the fence. My father was alarmed, and for the first time he saw me then, cried out and sprang back from the window. I remember that very well. I ran across the garden to the fence. And there Grigory caught me when I was sitting on the fence."
At that point he raised his eyes at last and looked at his listeners. They seemed to be staring at him with perfectly unruffled attention. A sort of paroxysm of indignation seized on Mitya's soul.
"Why, you're laughing at me this moment, gentlemen," he broke off suddenly.
"What makes you think that?" observed Nikolai Parfenovich.
"You don't believe one word, that's why. I understand, of course, that I've come to the vital point. The old man's lying there now with his skull broken, while I, after dramatically describing how I wanted to kill him, and how I snatched up the pestle, I suddenly run away from the window. A romance. Poetry. As though one could believe a fellow on his word. Ha ha, you're scoffers, gentlemen."
And he swung round on his chair so that it creaked.
"And did you notice," asked the prosecutor suddenly, as though not observing Mitya's excitement, "did you notice, when you ran away from the window, whether the door into the garden was open?"
"No, it was not open."
"It was not?"
"It was shut. And who could open it? Bah, the door. Wait a bit."
He seemed suddenly to bethink himself, and almost with a start.
"Why, did you find the door open?"
"Yes, it was open."
"Why, who could have opened it if you did not open it yourselves?"
cried Mitya, greatly astonished.
"The door stood open. Your father's murderer undoubtedly went in at that door, and having accomplished the crime, went out again by the same door."
The prosecutor pronounced deliberately, as though chiselling out each word separately.
"That is perfectly clear. The murder was committed in the room and not through the window. That is absolutely certain from the examination that has been made, from the position of the body and everything. There can be no doubt of that circumstance."
Mitya was absolutely dumbfounded.
"But that's utterly impossible," he cried, completely at a loss. I didn't go in. I tell you positively, definitely, the door was shut the whole time I was in the garden, and when I ran out of the garden, I only stood at the window and saw him through the window, that's all, that's all. I remember to the last minute, and if I didn't remember, it would be just the same. I know it, for no one knew the signals except Smerdyakov and me and the dead man, and he wouldn't have opened the door to anyone in the world without the signals."
"Signals? What signals?"
asked the prosecutor with greedy, almost hysterical curiosity. He instantly lost all trace of his reserve and dignity. He asked the question with a sort of cringing timidity. He scented an important fact of which he'd known nothing, and was already filled with dread that Mitya might be unwilling to disclose it.
"So you didn't know?"
Mitya winked at him with a malicious and mocking smile.
"What if I won't tell you? From whom could you find out? No one knew about the signals except my father, Smerdyakov, and me. That was all. Heaven knew, too, but it won't tell you. But it's an interesting fact. There's no knowing what you might build on. Take comfort, gentlemen, I'll reveal it. You've some foolish idea in your hearts. You don't know the man you have to deal with. You have to do with a prisoner who gives evidence against himself to his own damage. Yes, for I'm a man of honour, and you are not."
The prosecutor swallowed this without a murmur. He was trembling with impatience to hear the new fact. Minutely and diffusely, Mitya told them everything about the signals invented by Fyodor Pavlovich for Smerdyakov. He told them exactly what every tap on the window meant. Tap the signals on the table. And when Nikolai Parfenovich said that he supposed he, Mitya, had tapped the signal, "Grushenka has come," when he tapped to his father, he answered precisely that he had tapped that signal, that Grushenka had come.
"So now you can build up your tower."
Mitya broke off and again turned away from them contemptuously.
"So no one knew of the signals but your dead father, you, and the valet Smerdyakov? And no one else?"
Nikolai Parfenovich inquired once more.
"Yes, the valet Smerdyakov, and heaven. Write down about heaven. That may be of use. Besides, you'll need God yourselves."
And they had already, of course, begun writing it down, but while they wrote, the prosecutor said suddenly, as though pitching on a new idea,
"But if Smerdyakov also knew of these signals, and you absolutely deny all responsibility for the death of your father, Was it not he, perhaps, who knocked the signal agreed upon, induced your father to open to him, and then committed the crime?
Mitya turned upon him a look of profound irony and intense hatred. His silent stare lasted so long that it made the prosecutor blink.
"You've caught the fox again," commented Mitya at last. "You've caught the beast by the tail. I see through you, Mr. Prosecutor. You thought, of course, that I should jump at that catch at your prompting and shout with all my might, 'Aye, it's Smerdyakov, he's the murderer.' Confess that's what you thought. Confess, and I'll go on."
But the prosecutor did not confess. He held his tongue and waited.
"You're mistaken. I'm not going to shout at Smerdyakov," said Mitya. "And you don't even suspect him?" "Why, do you suspect him?" "He is suspected, too."
Mitya fixed his eyes on the floor.
"Joking apart,"
he brought out gloomily, "listen. From the very beginning, almost from the moment when I ran out to you from behind the curtain, I've had the thought of Smerdyakov in my mind. I've been sitting here shouting that I'm innocent, thinking all the time, 'Smerdyakov. I can't get Smerdyakov out of my head. In fact, I too thought of Smerdyakov just now, but only for a second. Almost at once I thought, no, it's not Smerdyakov. It's not his doing, gentlemen."
"In that case, is there anybody else you suspect?" Nikolai Parfenovich inquired cautiously.
"I don't know anyone it could be, whether it's the hand of heaven or of Satan, but not Smerdyakov."
Hitler jerked out with decision. "But what makes you affirm so confidently and emphatically that it's not he?"
"From my conviction, my impression. Because Smerdyakov is a man of the most abject character and a coward. He's not a coward, he's the epitome of all the cowardice in the world, walking on two legs. He has the heart of a chicken. When he talked to me, he was always trembling for fear I should kill him, though I never raised my hand against him. He fell at my feet and blubbered. He's kissed these very boots, literally, beseeching me not to frighten him. Do you hear? Not to frighten him." "What a thing to say." "Why, I offered him money. He's a puling chicken. Sickly, epileptic, weak-minded. A child of 8 could thrash him. He has no character worth talking about. It's not Smerdyakov, gentlemen. He doesn't care for money. He wouldn't take my presents. Besides, what motive had he for murdering the old man? Why, he's very likely his son, you know, his natural son. Do you know that?"
The woman listened to him, looking down with her cheek in her hand. She sighed deeply.
"My Nikita tried to comfort me with the same words as you. 'Foolish one,' he said, 'why weep? Our son is no doubt singing with the angels before God.' He says that to me, but he weeps himself. I see that he cries like me. 'I know,' Nikita said I, 'where could he be if not with the Lord God? Only here with us now he is not as he used to sit beside us before. And if I only could look upon him one little time, if only I could peep at him one little time without going up to him, without speaking, if I could be hidden in a corner and only see him for one little minute, hear him playing in the yard, calling in his little voice, "Mammy, where are you?" If only I could hear him pattering with his little feet about the room just once, only once. For so often, I remember how he used to run to me and shout and laugh. If only I could hear his little feet, I should know him. But he's gone, Father, he's gone. I shall never hear him again. Here's his little sash. But him, I shall never see or hear now."
She drew out of her bosom her boy's little embroidered sash, and as soon as she looked at it, she began shaking with sobs, hiding her eyes with her fingers, through which the tears flowed in a sudden stream.
"It is Rachel of old," said the elder, "weeping for her children, and will not be comforted because they are not. Such is the lot set on earth for you mothers. Be not comforted. Consolation is not what you need. Weep and be not consoled, but weep. Only every time that you weep, be sure to remember that your little son is one of the angels of God.
"'that he looks down from there at you and sees you "'and rejoices at your tears and points at them to the Lord God. "'And a long while yet you will keep that great mother's grief. "'But it will turn in the end into quiet joy, "'and your bitter tears will be only tears of tender sorrow "'that purifies the heart and delivers it from sin. "'And I shall pray for the peace of your child's soul. "'What was his name?'
"'Alexei, father.
"'A sweet name. "'After Alexei, the man of God.
"'Yes, father.
"'What a saint he was. "'I will remember him, mother, and your grief in my prayers, "'and I will pray for your husband's health. "'It is a sin for you to leave him. "'Your little one will see from heaven that you have forsaken his father, "'and will weep over you.' Why do you trouble his happiness? He is living, for the soul lives forever. And though he is not in the house, he is near you, unseen. How can he go into the house when you say that the house is hateful to you? To whom is he to go if he finds you not together, his father and mother? He comes to you in dreams now, and you grieve, but then he will send you gentle dreams. Go to your husband, mother. Go this very day.
I will go, father, at your word. I will go. You've gone straight to my heart. My Nikita, you're waiting for me.
The woman began in a sing-song voice, but the elder had already turned away to a very old woman, dressed like a dweller in the town, not like a pilgrim. Her eyes showed that she'd come with an object, and in order to say something... She said she was the widow of a non-commissioned officer and lived close by in the town. Her son, Vasenka, was in the commissariat service and had gone to Irkutsk in Siberia. He had written twice from there, but now a year had passed since he had written. She did inquire about him, but she did not know the proper place to inquire.
Only the other day, Stepanida Ilyinishna, she's a rich merchant's wife, said to me, "'You go, Prohorovna, and put your son's name down for prayer in the church "'and pray for the peace of his soul as though he were dead. "'His soul will be troubled,' she said, "'and he'll write you a letter.' "'And Stepanida Ilyinishna told me it was a certain thing "'which had been many times tried. "'Only I'm in doubt. "'Oh, you light of ours, is it true or false, and would it be right?'
"'Don't think of it. It's shameful to ask the question.' How is it possible to pray for the peace of a living soul? And his own mother, too, it's a great sin akin to sorcery. Only for your ignorance, it is forgiven you. Better pray to the Queen of Heaven, our swift defense and help, for his good health, and that she may forgive you for your error. And another thing I will tell you, Prohorovna, either he will soon come back to you, your son, or he will be sure to send a letter. Go... "'and henceforward be in peace. "'Your son is alive, I tell you.'
"'Dear Father, God reward you, our benefactor, "'who prays for all of us and for our sins.'
"'But the elder had already noticed in the crowd "'two glowing eyes fixed upon him. "'An exhausted, consumptive-looking, though young, "'peasant woman was gazing at him in silence. "'Her eyes besought him, but she seemed afraid to approach.
"'What is it, my child?'
"'Absolve my soul, father,'
she articulated softly and slowly, sank on her knees and bowed down at his feet.
"'I have sinned, father. I'm afraid of my sin.'
The elder sat down on the lower step. The woman crept closer to him, still on her knees.
"'I am a widow these 3 years,'
she began in a half-whisper with a sort of shudder.
"'I had a hard life with my husband. He was an old man.' He used to beat me cruelly. He lay ill. I thought, looking at him, if he were to get well, if he were to get up again, what then? And then the thought came to me,
"Stay,"
said the elder, and he put his ear close to her lips. The woman went on in a low whisper, so that it was almost impossible to catch anything. She had soon done.
3 years ago...
asked the elder.
3 years. At first I didn't think about it, but now I've begun to be ill, and the thought never leaves me.
Have you come from far?
Over 300 miles away.
Have you told it in confession?
I have confessed it twice. I have confessed it.
Have you been admitted to communion?
Yes. I'm afraid to die.
Fear nothing and never be afraid, and don't fret. If only your penitence fail not, God will forgive all. There is no sin, and there can be no sin on all the earth, which the Lord will not forgive to the truly repentant. Man cannot commit a sin so great as to exhaust the infinite love of God. Can there be a sin which could exceed the love of God? Think only of repentance, continual repentance, but dismiss fear altogether. Believe that God loves you as you cannot conceive, that he loves you with your sin in your sin. It has been said of old that over one repentant sinner there is more joy in heaven than over 10 righteous men. Go and fear not. Be not bitter against men. Be not angry if you are wronged. Forgive the dead man in your heart what wrong he did you. Be reconciled with him in truth. If you are penitent, you love. And if you love, you are of God. All things are atoned for, all things are saved by love. If I, a sinner, even as you are, am tender with you and have pity on you, how much more will God? Love is such a priceless treasure that you can redeem the whole world by it, and expiate not only your own sins but the sins of others. He signed her 3 times with the cross, took from his own neck a little icon, and put it upon her. She bowed down to the earth without speaking. He got up and looked cheerfully at a healthy peasant woman with a tiny baby in her arms.
From Vyshegorye, dear father.
5 miles you have dragged yourself with the baby. What do you want?
I've come to look at you. I have been to you before, or have you forgotten? You've no great memory if you've forgotten me. They told us you were ill. Thinks I'll go and see him for myself. Now I see you and you're not ill. You'll live another 20 years. God bless you. There are plenty to pray for you. How should you be ill?
I thank you for all, daughter.
By the way, I have a thing to ask, not a great one. Here are 60 kopecks. Give them, dear father, to someone poorer than me. I thought as I came along, better give through him. He'll know whom to give to.
Thanks, my dear, thanks. You are a good woman. I love you. I will do so, certainly. Is that your little girl?
My little girl, father, Lizaveta.
May the Lord bless you both, you and your babe, Lizaveta. You have gladdened my heart, mother. Farewell, dear children, farewell, dear ones.
He blessed them all and bowed low to them.
We have heard that legend, but you are your father's son too, you know. Yet you yourself told everyone you meant to murder him.
That's a thrust, and a nasty mean one too. I'm not afraid. Oh, gentlemen, isn't it too base of you to say that to my face? It's base because I told you that myself. I not only wanted to murder him, but I might have done it. And what's more, I went out of my way to tell you of my own accord that I nearly murdered him. But you see, I didn't murder him, you see. My guardian angel saved me. That's what you've not taken into account. And that's why it's so base of you. For I didn't kill him. I didn't kill him. Do you hear? I did not kill him.
He was almost choking. He had not been so moved before during the whole interrogation.
And what has he told you, gentlemen? Smerdyakov, I mean.
He added suddenly after a pause.
May I ask that question?
You may ask any question, the prosecutor replied with frigid severity. Any question relating to the facts of the case, and we are, I repeat, bound to answer every inquiry you make. We found the servant Smerdyakov, concerning whom you inquire, lying unconscious in his bed in an epileptic fit of extreme severity that had recurred possibly 10 times. The doctor who was with us told us, after seeing him, that he may possibly not outlive the night. Well, if that's so, the devil must have killed him.
broke suddenly from Mitya, as though until that moment he had been asking himself, was it Smerdyakov or not?
"We will come back to this later," Nikolai Parfenovich decided. "Now, wouldn't you like to continue your statement?"
Mitya asked for a rest. His request was courteously granted. After resting, he went on with his story. But he was evidently depressed. He was exhausted, mortified, and morally shaken. To make things worse, the prosecutor exasperated him, as though intentionally, by vexatious interruptions about trifling points. Scarcely had Mitya described how, sitting on the wall, he had struck Grigory on the head with the pestle, while the old man had hold of his left leg, and how he had then jumped down to look at him, when the prosecutor stopped him to ask him to describe exactly how he was sitting on the wall. Mitya was surprised. "Oh, I was sitting like this, astride, one leg on one side of the wall and one on the other." "And the pestle?" "The pestle was in my hand." "Not in your pocket? Do you remember that precisely?" "Was it a violent blow you gave him?" "It must have been a violent blow, but why do you ask?" "Would you mind sitting on the chair just as you sat on the wall then, and showing us just how you moved your arm and in what direction?" "You're making fun of me, aren't you?" asked Mitya, looking haughtily at the speaker. But the latter did not flinch. Mitya turned abruptly, sat astride on his chair, and swung his arm. "This was how I struck him. That's how I knocked him down. What more do you want?" "Thank you. May I trouble you now to explain why you jumped down, with what object, and what you had in view?" "Oh, hang it, I jumped down to look at the man I'd hurt." "I don't know what for." "Though you were so excited and were running away?" "Yes, though I was excited and running away." "You wanted to help him?" "Help?" "Yes, perhaps I did want to help him. I don't remember." "You don't remember? Then you didn't quite know what you were doing?" "Not at all. I remember everything, every detail. I jumped down to look at him and wiped his face with my handkerchief." "We've seen your handkerchief. Did you hope to restore him to consciousness?" "I don't know whether I hoped it. I simply wanted to make sure whether he was alive or not." "Ah, you wanted to be sure. Well, what then?" "I'm not a doctor. I couldn't decide. I ran away thinking I'd killed him. And now he's recovered." "Excellent," commented the prosecutor. "Thank you. That's all I wanted. Kindly proceed."
Alas, it never entered Mitya's head to tell them, though he remembered it, that he had jumped back from pity, and standing over the prostrate figure had even uttered some words of regret. "You've come to grief, old man. There's no help for it. Well, there you must lie." The prosecutor could only draw one conclusion, that the man had jumped back at such a moment and in such excitement simply with the object of ascertaining whether the only witness of his crime were dead, that he must therefore have been a man of great strength, coolness, decision, and foresight, even at such a moment. And so on. The prosecutor was satisfied. "I provoked the nervous fellow by trifles, and he has said more than he meant to." With painful effort, Mitya went on, but this time he was pulled up immediately by Nikolai Parfenovich. "How came you to run to the servant, Fedosya Markova, with your hands so covered with blood, and, as it appears, your face too?"
"Well, I didn't notice the blood at all at the time," answered Mitya.
"That's quite likely. It does happen sometimes."
The prosecutor exchanged glances with Nikolai Parfenovich.
"I simply didn't notice you quite right there, prosecutor,"
Mitya assented suddenly. Next came the account of Mitya's sudden determination to step aside and make way for their happiness. But he could not make up his mind to open his heart to them as before and tell them about the queen of his soul. He disliked speaking of her before these chilly persons, who were fastening on him like bugs. And so, in response to their reiterated questions, he answered briefly and abruptly,
"Well, I made up my mind to kill myself. What had I left to live for?" That question stared me in the face. Her first rightful lover had come back, the man who wronged her but had hurried back to offer his love, after 5 years, and atone for the wrong with marriage. So I knew it was all over for me. And behind me, disgrace, and that blood, Grigory's. What had I to live for?
So I went to redeem the pistols I'd pledged to load them, put a bullet in my brain tomorrow.
And a grand feast the night before?
Yes, a grand feast the night before. Damn it, all gentlemen, do make haste and finish it. I meant to shoot myself not far from here, beyond the village, and I'd planned to do it at 5 o'clock in the morning, and I had a note in my pocket already. I wrote it at Perrotin's when I loaded my pistols. Here's the letter, read it. It's not for you, I tell it,
he added contemptuously. He took it from his waistcoat pocket and flung it on the table. The lawyers read it with curiosity, and as is usual, added it to the papers connected with the case.
And you didn't even think of washing your hands at Perrotin's? You were not afraid, then, of arousing suspicion?
What suspicion? Suspicion or not, I should have galloped here just the same and shot myself at 5 o'clock, and you wouldn't have been in time to do anything. If it hadn't been for what's happened to my father, you would have known nothing about it and wouldn't have come here.
Oh, it's the devil's doing. It was the devil murdered father. It was through the devil that you found it out so soon. How did you manage to get here so quick? It's marvellous. A dream.
Mr. Perrotin informed us that when you came to him, you held in your hands, your blood-stained hands, your money, a lot of money, a bundle of 100-ruble notes, and that his servant boy saw it too.
That's true, gentlemen, I remember it was so.
Now this one little point presents itself. Can you inform us, Nikolai Parfenovitch began with extreme gentleness, where did you get so much money all of a sudden, when it appears from the facts, from the reckoning of time, that you had not been home? The prosecutor's brows contracted at the question being asked so plainly, but he did not interrupt Nikolai Parfenovitch.
No, I didn't go home,
answered Mitya, apparently perfectly composed, but looking at the floor. Allow me, then, to repeat my question. Nikolai Parfenovitch went on as though creeping up to the subject. Where were you able to procure such a sum all at once when, by your own confession, at 5 o'clock the same day you...
I was in want of 10 rubles and pledged my pistols with Perrotin, and then went to Madame Holokov to borrow 3,000, which she wouldn't give me, and so on, and all the rest of it.
Mitya interrupted sharply.
Yes, gentlemen, I was in want of it, and suddenly thousands turned up, eh? Do you know, gentlemen, you're both afraid now. What if he won't tell us where he got it? That's just how it is. I'm not going to tell you, gentlemen. You've guessed right. You'll never know,
said Mitya, chipping out each word with extraordinary determination. The lawyers were silent for a moment. You must understand, Mr. Karamazov, that it is of vital importance for us to know, said Nikolai Parfenovitch, softly and suavely.
I understand, but still I won't tell you.
The prosecutor, too, intervened and again reminded him that the prisoner was at liberty to refuse to answer questions, if he thought it to his interest, and so on. But in view of the damage he might do himself by his silence, especially in a case of such importance as...
And so on, gentlemen, and so on. Enough! I've heard that rigmarole before,
Mitya interrupted again.
I can see for myself how important it is, and that this is the vital point, and still, I won't say...
What is it to us? It's not our business, but yours. You are doing yourself harm, observed Nikolai Parfenovitch nervously.
You see, gentlemen, joking apart.
Mitya lifted his eyes and looked firmly at them both.
I had an inkling from the first that we should come to loggerheads at this point. But at first, when I began to give my evidence, it was all still far away and misty. It was all floating. And I was so simple that I began with the supposition of mutual confidence existing between us. Now I can see for myself that such confidence is out of the question. For in my case, we were bound to come to this cursed stumbling block. And now we've come to it. It's impossible, and there's an end of it. But I don't blame you. You can't believe it all simply on my word. I understand that, of course.
He relapsed into gloomy silence. Couldn't you, without abandoning your resolution to be silent about the chief point, could you not at the same time give us some slight hint as to the nature of the motives which are strong enough to induce you to refuse to answer, at a crisis so full of danger to you? Mitya smiled mournfully, almost dreamily.
I'm much more good-natured than you think, gentlemen. I'll tell you the reason why and give you that hint, though you don't deserve it. I won't speak of that, gentlemen, because it would be a stain on my honour. The answer to the question where I got the money would expose me to far greater disgrace than the murder and robbing of my father.
if I had murdered and robbed him. That's why I can't tell you. I can't for fear of disgrace. What, gentlemen, are you going to write that down?
Yes, we'll write it down,
lisped Nikolai Parfenovich. You ought not to write that down about disgrace. I only told you that in the goodness of my heart. I needn't have told you. I made you a present of it, so to speak, and you pounce upon it at once. Ah, well.